welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Insane City is Dave Barry's first solo novel in 10 years, following his New York Times best-selling novels, Big Trouble and Tricky Business. But he certainly has been very, very busy in the meantime. The Pulitzer Prize-winning humorist has a Tony Award-winning show on Broadway, Peter and the Starcatcher. And he also is the author of the critically acclaimed collaboration with Alan Zweibel, Lunatics, which was bought by the Movies for a Film to star Steve Carell. In Insane City, Barry returns to the comic suspense genre of which he is a past master. Here is a madcap, very complicated, heartfelt tale of a groom, Seth Weinstein, and his numbskull posse of pals set on the eve of his spectacular wedding when things go terribly, terribly wrong. It's a great pleasure to welcome Dave Barry to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Joe. Thanks for having me.
You know, you've been on many times since your last solo novel, as I mentioned, a little over 10 years ago. And I think I always concluded the interview by saying to you, When will you do one of those again? When will you do one of those again? Because I love Big Trouble. I love those books so much. So then to have this come was a wonderful gift. Was there a reluctance on your part to do this type of novel, or is it a market force? what kept you out of that realm for so long?
Really not. There was no plan behind it. What happened is I got sidetracked by young adult fiction. Ridley Pearson and I wrote Peter and the Starcatchers not too long after my last adult novel. And we both thought that was just going to be a real quick thing, a short book about where Peter Pan came from. And it ended up being a 550-page book and did really well. And we really enjoyed working together. We really enjoyed writing for young people. And so we ended up writing four more of those and another book or two together. And that just sort of swept me up for a bunch of years. But I always thought about coming back and writing a novel. And it's kind of waiting for an idea to hit me. And then when I had what I thought was a good idea for a plot that would kind of hold together for the whole book, I started working on Insane City. So it wasn't really nothing intentional. And also, of course, I wanted to write a book for you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And indeed you did. I said in the introduction that it is, and I think that's what's so wonderful about these books, is these are very complicated lives. There is so much going on, and it's so bizarre and so wonderful and so, well, yes, it's funny, and it's also just bizarre in many cases, but you pull this off in perfect normalcy, and and I'm curious as to when you talk about that plotting of how long or what the process is getting you to that point where you realize there are going to be all these bumps in the road and how they'll work into the overall story.
To me, plotting is the hard part of writing a novel. And because I don't think of myself as a great literary writer. I think of myself as a guy who tells jokes and likes to string them together into a story. So I want to, and the kind of book I like to read is a book where lots and lots and lots of stuff happens. I'm not into introspective books. I'm trying to write a book where like something is happening all the time, and you're wondering how is that all gonna work out. Believe it or not, the plotter I think about when I sit down to write a book is P.G. Woodhouse. those Landing's Castle farces where 10 different characters are pursuing 10 different separate goals, and somehow it all comes together, and there's sort of a sense of frantic craziness about it all, and yet it all works out in the end. That's the kind of plot I like. I kind of knew where I wanted it to end this book, what I wanted to happen in the end. I did set at the center of the plot an actually sort of serious issue, this groom, Seth, who's about to get married, is presented with a moral dilemma. He has a lot of other dilemmas, not the least of which is that his wedding ring has fallen into the hands of an orangutan. But beyond all those problems is a deeper problem, a moral dilemma involving some Haitian refugees. And I knew that that was going to be kind of the heart of the plot, and everything else would weave around it and end up being involved with it. But it took a long time to figure out how to get it all to come together in a way that would seem, I mean, if not necessarily realistic, at least sort of in terms of the book, plausible and be funny at the same time.
And especially given your home state of Florida, where the action takes place around Miami, this is very much a story of that state, as your earlier novels were as well. And I think, you know, going back to an earlier point, not only what you just said about the Haitian refugees, but just about the madcap nature, that all seems to make sense in a book that takes place in Florida.
Yeah, Miami is a character in this book. Miami is the insane city, and I live in Miami. I moved there in 1986 from the United States, and I have never lived any place weirder. I mean, nothing approaching the weirdness level of Miami. And so the things that happen in this book, as I like to say, it's not necessarily wouldn't necessarily all happen to the same person on the same weekend as they do in my book. But they're all things that could happen. There are guys in Miami walking around, as one of the characters in this book does, with a very large Burmese python around his shoulder, sort of as a fashion accessory. There are bars in Miami where if you go in, you might suddenly find yourself being befriended by a beautiful woman who much, much later in the evening turns out to be working for Russian mobsters, and whose goal is going to be to extract as much money from you as possible. That stuff really happens in Miami, not to mention the traffic and the sort of level of the insane level of crime. All those things can happen, and I kind of I brought them all into the story. So it's very much the city is a character in this book.
I've talked to Carl Hyacin, who also writes novels that take place in Florida and are very madcap in nature. And we've talked about how difficult it is to sort of top reality of beating what is just in the paper every day.
And yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, and it seems like that would be a real issue.
Yeah, it's funny because I have a snake in my book that plays a role, a snake named Blossom. But just when I was getting ready to go on this book tour, the state of Florida decided that the way to solve the problem of the Burmese pythons that have invaded the Everglades, there's like hundreds of thousands of Burmese pythons out in the Everglades eating all the other wildlife. They have no enemies out there, and they get to be huge, and they reproduce like crazy. So the state of Florida now is running what they called a python challenge, which is they've invited people, anybody, you, if you want, can pay, I think, $25, and you take an online course, and then you can go down to the Florida Everglades and kill as many pythons as you can in a humane manner. I should stress that that's one of the rules of the contest. But there's like a $1,500 cash prize for whoever kills the most Burmese pythons and a $1,000 prize for whoever kills the longest one. Now, that if that's not a Carl Hyacin novel setup, I don't know what is. I'm sure Carl will eventually. But, you know, it's true. You can't write anything weirder than what is actually happening. In the last year, we had a cannibal attack on a causeway. We had a guy who died in a cockroach eating contest. In I think it was Fort Lauderdale, the winner of this contest, it was run, I believe, by a pet store, would win a snake. You know, if you put that in a novel, oh yeah, one of your characters enters a cockroach eating contest to win a snake, and he dies from eating cockroach. Everybody would say, come on, but that actually happened in Miami.
You have a scene in the book regarding, and I'll let you describe it, but regarding a pirate ship.
Yeah. The main character, Seth, ends up fleeing the police with some Haitian refugees and a guy with a snake. And they board a pirate ship that sails out of a place called Bayside, called El Barco Loco. And there really is a Bayside marketplace in Miami. And there really is a pirate ship based there. I don't think it's called El Barco Loco, but that's what I was basing it on. and it carries tourists. But these guys end up they're fleeing. Actually, they're fleeing in this scene. A couple of thugs who have commandeered another boat that goes out of Bayside, a sightseeing boat, which they regularly go out of Bayside. So there's a battle on the high seas between the El Barco Loco and the sightseeing boat that has been commandeered. And at one point, the Seth and his friends fend off the bad guys who are trying to board them by shooting frozen chicken nuggets out of a propane cannon. And I don't think that's probably happened yet.
Well, that was like, my question. That's why I wanted you to describe it, because when I was reading this, I was wondering, I wonder if that had to be checked of saying, well, let's just make sure that really never happened.
To be honest, like if I were to pick up the paper today and see that there was a fight between two boats in Biscayne Bay and one of them was shooting frozen chicken nuggets at the other, I would not be totally surprised.
Dave Barry is our guest on the book show this week. The new novel is Insane City, and it is published by Putnam. In writing a book like this, your background, of course, is journalism, writing humor columns, writing on a deadline. Is this a freedom from that, or do you still have to be very disciplined?
Oh, yeah, you do. I mean, the problem with books is... eventually you have to finish them. but it's never right now, or it never feels like it's right now. When I was writing newspaper columns regularly, I always knew I had a weekly deadline. I had to finish it. And the rhythms of my life revolved around that. With books, you know, it could be months, could be sometimes even more than a year away, which is a wonderful, comfortable feeling when it's, you know, year away. But then as it gets closer and closer, you realize, you know, I have to write a lot of words and get it in. So the only way to do it is to just, and every writer I know does this, you know, is just get into the habit of writing every day, getting something written. If you don't do that, you won't have it done. Now, there are authors, and to be honest, I do know some of these as well, who they basically write the entire book in the last few weeks, which is, to me, inconceivable. And they go crazy, these people. They go insane. But I can't do it that way. I have to get a lot of it done ahead of time, or I'd be unable to do it.
I used the word freedom in my previous question, and I'm curious because we talk about what you've been doing since your last solo novel, and a lot of that has been writing with other people. You're writing with Ridley Pearson, writing with Alan Zweibel. And what is it like, first of all, to have that partnership with another writer, and in both those cases, damn good writers, and then to be on your own where it's just your imagination?
There's pluses and minuses for both. When you're writing on your own, you really don't have to compromise anything with anybody, and you can make all the decisions, and that's great. That freedom is great. On the other hand, you are then on your own. You know, you don't get to bounce it off somebody else. He might have a better idea than you, or might see a problem with what you're doing. So you know, you have to you may lose some good criticism and a lot of good help. The real minus, though, is I liked going on book tour with both of those guys. It's a lot of fun, you know, because book tours are not usually fun. Book tours are usually kind of, you know, endurance. I'm early in this one, so I'm still at energy. But you know, after a couple of weeks, it can really wear you down. And it's great when you have somebody else there going through it with you, for when you're getting a beer late at night afterward and you know, say, I can't believe the way you answered that question, that kind of discussion. So pluses and minuses. But I did feel that, like in this case, I knew this was my book. This is a book where it was really a story I completely thought of and really felt that I was the guy to write it. So this one felt good to do just for me.
I would assume there's a pride that comes in with that.
Yeah. I mean, you know... It's pride, and it's also fear. You go, you know,
because you know, you spend all this time.
I know, you send it out in the world, and then you don't know. You never know with books. I mean, if you're John Grisham, you do know, but Most of us, we don't know when we write a book, what's really going to happen to it when it gets out there. And you've invested so much time in it. The beauty of writing newspaper columns is, you know, you write it, it's out there almost immediately. It gets some reaction one way or the other, and then it's gone. You're on to the next one. You don't really have to spend a lot of time talking about it or thinking about it or worrying about it. But with books, you do.
This is, with that said, this is your 38th book.
Well, but let's clarify. Some of those are collections of columns, and some of them are pretty short. if you added it all together, it's probably the equivalent of the Stand.
Okay. One
in terms of
book.
Word count. Yeah.
And but meaning that you've put the product out there and people, is there a point in your career where, I mean, you always said that there's that fear, but you realized that you had an audience, that you were connecting with people, that they were, as I think you once said to me, that they were actually laughing at the booger jokes.
Yeah, no, I know that I have fans and they I have loyal, great, wonderful fans that have been reading my stuff for years, but. You know, you in a way that is also pressure. You really don't want to let those people down. You know, if they expect a certain kind of book from you, you really want them to get that. But you also want to kind of surprise them a little bit or make them think, wow, that you know, I didn't see that coming. So there's pressure there as well. I you're right though. I mean, I don't think it's the same for me as if I were writing a first time novelist. That's a rough world to be in, first-time novelist, because you don't have an audience yet, and it's really hard to get any attention for what you've written, and that you have to be pretty stoic about going to book signings when you know where only four people show up, and dealing with the fact that you know you're kind of almost hand-selling your book. I don't have to do that, and I'm really grateful that I don't have to do that. So I guess it's better this way.
In our Twitter world, do you ever miss the 500 or 750 word weekly humor column?
Yeah, it's really gone. It's been Twitterized. I still think there's a lot of great humor being written, even some of it like on the internet, like Andy Borowitz, people like that, you know, still kind of essentially writing column,
yeah.
Pretty great humor columns, but a lot of what would have become columns have been reduced to just like one-liners on Twitter. The really good humor writing now, I think, is mostly going to TV. You know, shows like The Office and Parks and Recreation and South Park and Portlandia. There's lots of funny, I think, really funny shows on television. And I think that's where, if you were a young humor writer, you'd be much more likely to look than newspapers, which are, you know, increasingly being marginalized and don't have much space and are, I think, unlikely to take on new columnists, give them space because there's just not much space left. And I do miss that. I mean, when I started writing humor columns, it was in the 70s, and Irma Bombeck and Art Buchwald and Russell Baker and Art Hoppe and people like that were really well known and had wide, wide circulation, I mean, many, many newspapers. I just don't think there's anything like that left.
And that seems a shame to me. And I wonder if there could be, as we look to our tablets and we want to sit down and look at content, if that will ever come back.
I don't know. I mean, you think about what those columns were. They were writing about issues of the day, and it would, you know, something would happen, and a couple of days later, there'd be Art Buchwald's column about it. Now, something happens, and that night, Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert, Jay Leno, David Letterman, all those people with all those joke writers just pour it on. And meanwhile, during that day, there've been, 8,000 tweets about it. So, like, every joke, you know, every possible kind of joke has already been done. And then next day you're on to the next thing. So it's just a difficult form now to sit and write a 750, 800 word humor essay on politics. Not so easy anymore. I really never did that. I mean, my humor was generally, I might mention things that are happening in the news, but not, that wasn't really what I mainly did. I mainly wrote about whatever I was thinking about or you know, popular culture, going to the supermarket, that kind of thing. But I don't think anybody anymore is writing humor essays about current events.
And you mentioned Art Buchwald and, of course, Irma Bombeck and yourself when you were writing these columns. There still really weren't that many of you doing it.
No, but, you know, those I'm naming the people that were widely syndicated, but almost every paper had some kind of humor writer. Most big city papers. And I left Mike Royko out, but obviously he was one of the
Chicago.
Big ones. Most towns. There was somebody, even if he was only not syndicated nationally, but he was local, or she was writing about, you know, writing humor essays about politics and about the local community. Then that position doesn't exist anymore, I don't think, the way it used to. It just doesn't.
I think it's interesting because you talk about of writing jokes and thinking of that, and I know you've even worked on the Academy Awards coming in and being one of many writers who are writing jokes. Is that you never thought of like a stand-up career or anything like that, did you?
No, I don't have anything like the level of need for approval or whatever it is that drives stand-ups to get up in front of an audience and risk bombing to get that love that, you know, that I think humor writers are shyer. You know, we like to have people laugh at our stuff, but we don't want to be there when they're doing it in case they didn't think it was funny. But I mean, and stand-up comics, I've known a few and you know, they're all insane. They're really all nuts. I mean, they're all smart, crazy people who are able to take this emotional risk of getting on a stage. And they're not, as a rule, happy people. And I know I'm generalizing there, but they, you know, they really do crave, they need to kill, as they say in the biz, you know, to get out there and get big laughs and be reassured night after night after night that they're funny, that they're great, that they're loved. So there's a lot of that mindset going on there, which humor writers I don't think have so much. I did enjoy. I worked for Steve Martin twice when he was hosting the Oscars, and I really enjoyed watching the process of how the jokes get written, which is a really interesting process in itself. The room full of writers, and then how the comic guy like Steve Martin, who was brilliant at it, takes that and is able to get up onto a stage and present it in a way that is funnier than you ever thought of in the room. I really enjoyed watching that and being part of it. That's not really what I ever want to do with my life, though. I mean, I'm not interested in writing jokes for other people to get to laughs. You know?
But was there a thrill in seeing him deliver a line you had written and to see it score?
Yes, that's a wonderful feeling, and you know, it's almost as good as if you got to deliver the line.
Right.
Part of the whole of the Academy Awards was pretty amazing for me, never having been in that world. Standing next to Halle Berry backstage was
not bad.
Very exciting for me. So I did enjoy it immensely. I just can't imagine doing it for a living. And there are some great, really smart people sitting in those rooms right as you and I speak, somewhere in L.A., sitting in a room with other really great, smart, funny people coming up with really great jokes, half of which you'll never hear. Because, you know, for one reason or another, they're inappropriate or just too filthy or whatever to get on whatever show it is. But really, really funny stuff being generated all the time out there.
I think of Johnny Carson after 30-plus years of being on the air of how he would still think of things and send jokes to David Letterman and just get the thrill of hearing him say them and have them work. And even after all of those years, still wanting that and how cool it is.
I think if you're born to do that, you're never going to stop doing that.
Well, this novel is amazing. It's just wonderfully funny and just a terrific read. It is Insane City. It is published by Putnam. Dave Barry, it's always a pleasure to speak to you. I thank you very, very much for spending time with us.
Appreciate it, and thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much. The name of the book is Insane City. It is published by Putnam. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.